Friends, we are delighted. We, Áine Sheridan and myself, are delighted to welcome John Fearick, Dean Emeritus, Fordham Law School, and he's actually better known in some circles as the creator of an amendment to the 25th Amendment of the Constitution of the United States, and that sets forth, the succession rules pertaining and relating to vacancies and disabilities of the offices of President and Vice President of the United States. Of course, as we welcome you, John, as a good friend of ours, I think it might be a good idea to skip over the current situation with respect to, our former president for the first time being indicted. And but what I would like to start by asking you, since you are the expert and have brought attention many times over to confidence in our justice system, I just want to ask you, as I welcome you, John, where are we at right now, despite all of the conflict we have in the United States, but if you could just address for us, do we have to re-evaluate? Do we have to, do we have to reprogram ourselves to have faith in the U.S. justice system?
I would just start by saying that my faith in our system remains strong because I believe in the values that we stand for in terms of equal justice for all. I think we, serving as lawyers certainly, and others in other areas, need to lift our commitment to the importance of community, the importance of having faith in those who serve us in the different branches of government, and not to lose hope and because of the polarization that obviously has emerged in America over, if not the world, over the past decade or so. I haven't lost faith. I have increased in different ways my own commitment to the American democracy and educating students at all levels about our Constitution.
Professor Dean Emeritus, I suppose we both of us can be forgiven, for I'm from the parish of Attymass, and the neighboring parish is Foxford. And in a book which you published, your memoir entitled "That Further Shore," and it's a memoir of Irish roots and the American promise. That was actually Fordham University Press in 2020. Can you carry us through again, or give us a synopsis of where your roots and the influence of your own family growing up in the county of Bronx?
Thank you. I am the oldest of two Irish immigrants who came to the United States, my mother in 1928 and my father in 1929 from County Mayo. My mother from the Foxford area and my father from the Ballon Robe area. And I grew up in a family that emphasized the importance of education and doing all you can to make differences in the world and be open to helping people. My father served in World War II helping military contractors build bases, barracks, and other needed items in areas such as Newfoundland, the Aleutian Islands, Greenland, Bermuda. And we didn't see a lot of my father during the war years. My mother gave us great love during those years, and we did see our Uncle Pat, who participated in the War of Independence in Ireland, often because he was my mother's brother, and we all fell in love with our Uncle Pat as well. After the war, my father began to operate trolleys, and then buses, and he was called on by the bus company to work in the money room because of trust people had in him in terms of counting money, and also he served as a dispatcher at different places in New York. So I saw in my parents that gave great energy and commitment to what they did. My mother in the home, my father outside the home. And my book tells the story of my parents. And it also includes my story because in so many ways the story of my parents include, obviously, the story of their children. And in my life, I had many opportunities. I accepted responsibilities. I pursued opportunities that came my way. And always was influenced by how important it was for me to do that, to honor the memory of my parents. And I talk about that in my book, and I'm grateful to Fordham University for publishing the book, and also grateful to all those who have shared notes with me through emails and other communications concerning the book. And I appreciate you, Adrian, because I think at some point you interviewed me when the book came out about the book, and I can't tell you how much I appreciated that on your part.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I just want to actually perhaps start in the Bronx. You grew up in a section of the Bronx practically in the shadow of Yankee Stadium.
Correct.
And was that considered at the time to be an Irish neighborhood, a multi-ethnic neighborhood? What was that going back to those early days?
I grew up, as you note, on 161st Street between Morris and Park Avenues, and a lot of other children of immigrants, obviously Irish immigrants, but also immigrants from Italy. And we had a few Jewish families in the area, and we so enjoyed sports such as stickball and curb ball, using a spalding, and also a broomstick, so to speak, for the stickball games. And we had a great community of effort. Those people of color live a little distance from us, but I came to attend a diverse school, high school, between 1950 and 54 called Bishop Dubois on 152nd Street and Amsterdam Avenue. And some of my best friends were, at the time that the Supreme Court was deciding Brown against Board of Education, were those of color. And I had a very rich Catholic education at St. Angelo Merisi Grammar School, taught by the Ursuline Sisters, for which my parents had no tuition bills to pay. And at Bishop Dubois High School, my father was able to negotiate a tuition of $5 a month for my 4 years. And then I went to Fordham College. And I saw a much larger world than I had grown up in terms of the county of the Bronx, and possibilities in that larger world for me to participate in different roles that I had thought about at that time, including as a manager of a supermarket, or as a priest. And then it came on me that perhaps I should become more involved in the political system of the United States through an education at Fordham Law School. And while I had some vision that I might participate in elected politics upon graduating from Fordham Law School, as it turned out, I was provided with an opportunity to participate in the crafting of the 25th Amendment to the United States Constitution. That was a unique amendment because it provided for filling a vacancy in the vice presidency whenever it occurred that did not exist in our original Constitution. And it also answered questions that were asked at the Constitution, Constitutional Convention, that received no answers. And that is, what is an inability that's covered by the 25th Amendment and the Constitution, and who has the power to determine it? And the 25th Amendment and its legislative history speaks quite abundantly of those subjects. And it's a great honor of my life to be able to assist those in Congress with respect to the creation of an amendment to the United States Constitution.
Now, you penned, an essay, coincidentally, a week before the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. And, people realized, I think, at that time, that there was no constitutional provision for a new vice president, and indeed your subject matter became of intense interest in Washington. So that would have been a time when, you became an overnight, legal star, as it were, because now what you had penned by way of a suggestion or a topic to be addressed, now here it was. And at that point, Dean Feerick, I want to ask you, what was the reaction in Washington? If there was a very shaky procedure for succession in the presidency and the vice presidency, how did that become resolved in the immediacy of then with the death of John F. Kennedy? How did that play out at that particular time?
When President Kennedy was assassinated on November 22, 1963, it gripped his death as the youngest president as of that point. It was a devastating kind of impact, mostly on so many people, including the members of Congress. And there had been a lot of thought given to the subject of how to handle a vice presidential vacancy, and also a disability of a president. And it was at the time a focus on in the media, in the newspapers, on those two subjects. And Congress had just put together Senator Birchbaugh and others in a committee of constitutional amendments as part of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and they had taken on, and others, addressing that subject that was, and that weakness in the Constitution that was exposed by the death of our president. And it put together, Senator Bayh and lawyers of the American Bar Association put together a committee of 12. And because I had written an article in the Fordham Law Review that was published a month before President Kennedy's assassination, and also called attention to the problem in a letter to the New York Times on, I think, November 17, 1963. I was invited to participate as a young member of that committee. And because of the work I had done studying that area since I had graduated from law school 2 years before, my work became relevant in terms of their reading of material and the history of the problem, and the leadership that President Eisenhower had given after suffering three disabilities in office. And he was not happy that Congress did not deal with the subject, and he put together a letter with his vice president to say, these protocols we're going to follow if I have another disability, and if I have a disability that is permanent, my plan would be to resign from office, and then make way for the vice president, the existing vice president, to take over the presidency. So it was a very it was a time also not only of the assassination of a president, exposing the weakness, but a time of possible nuclear war among the United States and the Soviet Union, and some security and safety became very important subjects in how the United States responds to those kind of threats. And it was a weakness in our system because of the succession provisions. And I had no idea when I started on that committee of the American Bar Association, and being asked also to chair the Young Lawyers Committee that they created, and having members in every state in the country, I had no idea, really, that one day I would be invited to the White House by President Johnson in 1967, where he wanted to proclaim that the 25th Amendment was now in the Constitution. It was an experience of a lifetime.
I think to cover your career would indeed take more time than we have allotted, or that has been allotted to me on radio, Irish Radio Network, and irishradio.com worldwide. But I do want to ask you about one particular aspect of your career. You had not taken the bar, and you had, as they say in Mayo, you had landed, you know, a good and with a good job in a relatively small law firm, which was growing and indeed grew to be one of the most prestigious law firms in New York. How did you decide or leave yourself open for recruitment into or back into a career that would indeed require you to you know, settle for a lot less revenue and pay than what you already had?
Well, let me just see if I can do this very quickly. The firm grew. The revenue that came into the firm grew. The partners, I became a partner in the firm. Compensation that went from $7,000 when I started at the firm in 1961 to many hundreds of thousands of dollars. And it continued to grow when I was in law practice, but at the same time I was heavily involved in this reform of our Constitution on presidential succession and then Electoral College reform. I put more time in on those subjects outside my office time, and those involvements gave me a passion for serving and making a difference. While I chose not to get involved in elective politics and remained as an independent, so that my credibility would not be challenged on subjects that had to do with the Constitution of the United States. And when it came time to for me to decide to leave the firm, which was not an easy decision because of the success of the firm, and I had become the practice leader at the firm in areas having to do with labor and management relations, and had a growing practice in that area. But the president of Fordham University, Father Fenley, who was born in Ireland, by the way, he asked me to consider putting my name in for the deanship because the Society of Jesus was very interested in developing an additional vision for this future of the school, and they had identified me as somebody that could contribute to that. And that was so empowering, my conversation with him, that money could not get in the way of changing my mindset, and that is to accept the responsibility of becoming dean of the law school. And then for the next 20 years, I served as faithfully as I could. And then for the next 20 years, which includes this moment, I became a law school teacher, and enjoying helping students gain experience and also knowledge of the subjects that I taught, which included ethics, the Constitution, and conflict resolution.
You know, to have a section of Fordham University, you know, dedicated to you, and of course the Feerick Center at Fordham Law School continues to thrive. You at some point along the way, I assume that retirement was a discussion, at least in your own house, with your good wife, Emily, and your kids. Somehow, you still keep going as if, you know, you were still trying to put the rent together. That is a passion that continues, and I would like to point out to this very day. Have there been a lot of changes either in attitude or in the teaching of law over the decades?
I would say that the one major change that I see from when I was a law student is the development of practical skills tied to the basic knowledge of the law and thinking like a lawyer, that's stressed in law school. At the time that I went to law school, there was no opportunity really in the form of a clinical education where law students represent the poor people and clients and under faculty supervision in our courts and in other forums. And Fordham Law School today has one of the best clinical programs in the entire United States, and that all began when I had the honor to serve as dean at the law school, and the school has built on those humble beginnings of clinical education, and you can't turn the corner at Fordham Law School without seeing an opportunity to participate in the work of a center like the one that I founded, the Center for Social Justice, where students, like just a week ago, went to El Paso, Texas, students who could speak Spanish, with the executive director of our Social Justice Center, to help people who are seeking consideration to be coming into our country be able to prepare and present their matters to administrative law judges. And that's just one form, you might say, of how law students today are doing service to communities that are vulnerable before they graduate from school under faculty supervision.
That, again, is not only laudable, but, you know, it says something about, you know, the law lawyers, those in the justice system that have gone above and beyond the definition of lawyer over the decades. I want to tell my listeners that, first of all, my guest is John Feerick, Dean Emeritus of Fordham Law School. I want to talk a little bit about something. I believe it has to be the bulk of 10 years ago when you brought to my attention a project which you were co-chairing, co-founding, and that was to do something, not just talk about it, but to do something about the Good Sisters and Kylemore Abbey in Connemara in County Galway. And at that time, I remember saying, oh, you know, as a youngster myself, back in the 50s, it was a great trip from, you know, from my section and your section at UMass Foxford. It was a great trip to get down to this marvelous castle, the most, you know, the Kylemore. And we, you know, we were aware that, you know, the sisters, the Benedictine sisters in Kylemore were not just taking... the part of their mission was not only to spend their time in prayer and educating, again, what was at that time an all-girls school, but that they were also took it one step further in that they showed, first of all, they became self-sufficient. They didn't mind dirtying their hands in the gardens, providing not food and fruit, everything for themselves, but also providing indeed the necessities for the less fortunate. In what was already considered to be a relatively poor area.
When I made my first trip to Ireland in 1989, I was then 52 years of age. I had supported my parents returning to Ireland ever since I had gotten out of law school. And I did not make my first trip until I was 52. I went up the coast of Ireland from the Shannon Airport and got a sense of its beauty. And at some point after arriving in County Mayo, Kylemore Abbey was mentioned to me as a place that I ought to visit. And we drove there. My wife and did a lot of the driving. I didn't feel secure driving on the different side of the road, so to speak. She had no difficulty doing that. And when we visited Kylemore Abbey, I fell in love with the Gothic church that's historic that was located there, and the very grounds of the abbey. You could walk along. And look at water in the distance, a mountain nearby, It was the most beautiful place I think I had ever seen. And when my mother died when I was in Ireland that week, and I then communicated with the sisters at the Abbey, whom I did not know, if it were possible to put the names of my father had died the year before. Is it possible to put the names of my parents somewhere? And I said to myself, I love Foxford. I love Ballinrobe. I did not want to pick one or the other. I had to celebrate both my parents. And I said Carmel Abbey would be the place where I would like both their names to appear. And the sisters, who received my letter request, decided to make possible my wish by putting their names on a pew in that Gothic church. And I sent them a very modest gift, but what value that I have received every time I go to Carmore since that time. I have to see the Gothic church, and I have to walk the paths and see the beautiful country and beauty of Carmore. It's a very spiritual place, and I've been to Ireland. I've been to Carmore a good 20 times, I would say, over the years, And those sisters are extraordinary, and what they're doing right now to achieve their first monastery is historic, because no women religious group of the Catholic Church has built a monastery in over 400 years in Ireland, and the sisters who occupy Carmel Abbey, 14 or so at the present time, are building a monastery that they have dreamt would be possible someday. And because of so many generous people, that monastery is being built right now. And I hope you don't mind if I mention to your audience that the committee of volunteers, many of whom are graduates of the school that existed at Carmore, and a number are graduates of Fordham Law School, decided that they wanted to honor this year in May as a way of furthering support for the sisters who are in a campaign to achieve $2 million representing increased cost since the pandemic began of the construction of the Abbey, which is being constructed as we talk. And we're well along in the campaign, and we are honored that to be able to honor Cardinal Dolan this year. And I know you haven't mentioned it, but I need to mention it. We're going to honor you for all that you have done to educate and promote the island of my parents, and also Christine McGinnis, a very outstanding lawyer, who has was selected just a year ago as a volunteer of the year in terms of Habitat for Humanity here in New York. And in terms of contributions to communities. So whenever I have a challenge in life, and I've sure had a lot of challenges over the past 10, 15 years, including the health of a daughter, including the health of my wife, including the health of other members of my family, and the health of friends. And I always call up and communicate with Carmore, and ask the sisters who pray every day if they would remember my family and my loved ones in their prayers. And I appreciate you putting the question to me concerning Carmel Abbey, because I would like to say to the audience, it's a beautiful place to have a memorial. It could be a tree, could be part of a garden. It could be in the monastery itself that is being built at this time to perpetuate your family history and a name that's important to you. And I'm so proud that the sisters put the names of my parents in the pew of that Gothic church. And I thank them for allowing me to be part of their campaign. And it's moving to be a successful campaign because of people who accept their honors, like you, Adrian, and also the Cardinal Dolan and Christine McGinnis.
Yeah, I first of all, to be honored at any event, a co-honoree with Cardinal Dolan, you know, is something that's a little bit scary. I was actually contemplating at this point, not contemplating, but I'm committed to actually getting my one suit cleaned rather than pressed for that occasion, because you know, it is, it's great to be honored, you know, with Christine McGinnis and Cardinal Timothy Dolan. But I would like, you know, to talk a little bit about, you know, Cardinal Dolan's commitment. God knows it lends itself to, you know, again, being part of a campaign, and to have Cardinal Dolan not only endorse, but to actually participate and to receive the honor, shows his level of interest as well. I think it's just marvelous.
Can I just add something? That the campaign to raise funds in America began at his residence in 2016. And I recall him saying at that time, Sister Magdalena was present from the Benedictine sisters, and a number of us on a small committee, really, helping the sisters in the United States, saying that that Irish priest and others from Ireland brought the Catholic faith to America, and in big ways and in different forms. And this was a time where we in America could help the sisters, those in Ireland, grow as their commitment is, the spirituality and Catholic faith in Ireland. And that's what these sisters are all about. And so it was our time here in America to return the benefit that we received, so many of us, from Irish priests who came to America.
I would like to, acknowledge that it is for me personally a huge honor, and I would like to revert to last year's Spirit of Kylemore Awards, where indeed you and another guest on today's program, Mike Dowling, had received that award. So I think that I'm in very good company and deserve, to be as happy and delighted as I am and honored. John, can we just can you bring us along from that initial meeting in the Cardinal's residence to you again as co-founder of the American Committee for Kylemore Abbey, reaching out to your associates, your friends, and getting that level of commitment that has indeed seen a tremendous level of donations over the last 6-7 years. That is something that, you know, it was not, that was a challenge. It was an undertaking, though, that was huge, considering that a lot of people only knew of Kylemore Abbey as a tourist attraction.
I once you become acquainted with the Abbey, in many ways, when I first saw the Abbey in 1989, it was a place to see, and I was a tourist, so to speak, in Ireland at that time, on my first visit. But once you become a tourist, you become exposed to its beauty and spirituality, and it's extraordinary because of the gardens. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, United States Supreme Court, who I encouraged to visit the Abbey, when I met her, subsequent to that, she said to me, "Thank you for telling me to go to Kylemore Abbey because they have the most beautiful gardens that she's ever seen, or among the most beautiful gardens that she's ever seen." And you can't help but being affected, as I was, by the beauty and and that's why it's a popular tourist place. But for me, it's not a tourist place. It's a place of spirituality and a sense of the presence of God.
Indeed. And the spirit of Kylemore Award, friends, for 2023 will be held on May. It's Wednesday, May 10th. And it's from 6 to 8 p.m. at a great, lovely location, Club 101, which is located at 101 Park Avenue. And the hosts for the event are Rose Gill, Principal Bloomberg, at Bloomberg, and Robert Riley, the former Assistant Dean at Fordham. And again, I would like and recommend, friends, that you get in touch with Mary Reed, who indeed is the marketing director for Kylemore Abbey. The telephone 914-420-3510, and her email mary.reed@kylemoreabbey.com. I wanted to keep you on the line, John, as we did the commercial announcement there, because I am sure that both Mary Reed and all of us would know that this is something very, very worthwhile supporting. And once more, I would like, because I was not aware, this is the first monastery to be built in Ireland in 400 years, or did I get that wrong?
As I understand it, it is by a religious order of women.
Wow. Okay.
And may I just add that Loretta Glucksmann was honored by the sisters last year, as well as the others that you mentioned, including myself.
Mike Dowling,
And Mike Dowling.
Well, again, I'm honored, but I'm also always delighted and welcome, you know, your participation in whatever it is that you're doing, because obviously there's no stopping you. And we look forward again. Thank you, good friend and Dean Emeritus of Fordham Law School, Professor John D. Feerick. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Thank you. God bless.
Bye now.